The views expressed in the following podcast are not necessarily the views of the United States Air Force or the Air Force Reserve, but rather the perspectives of the individual speakers. No endorsement of any particular person, business, or interest is ever intended.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on this 12th episode of Ready, Set, Airlift. I'm your host, Julian Hernandez from the Wing Public Affairs team. Today, we're getting a chance to learn a thing or two about the new boss at the Alamo Wing. Colonel Douglas Jeffrey will assume command of the 433rd Airlift Wing on Sunday, August 4th. He's already been on the ground here, getting up to speed on all things Alamo Wing. Ahead of the official transition this weekend, I sat down with Colonel Jeffrey for an opportunity to get to know him beyond what's available in his official Air Force biography, and to find out a little bit about his plans for the 433rd. Sir, first and foremost, welcome to the wing. How are you enjoying your first 30 days? Are we at 30 days yet?
We're almost there. It's been awesome, and it's been a whirlwind.
I can only imagine, yeah, the first few days transitioning into Lackland and coming back to Texas and whole new wing at your disposal. So, sir, I want to get us going to give airmen an idea of just yourself, your background, right? Why did you join the Air Force?
It's a great question. My granddad actually served in World War II as a weatherman, and he actually was on active duty for a while, got to hang out in Hollywood and do some things, and he always told me some neat stories, and he went up to Alaska. He was stationed in the Aleutian Islands. So I had heard his stories, and I go into those stories later because there's some pretty funny stories. But then my dad also served as a JAG in the Air Force up at DC. He was Captain Computer. He was an electrical engineer from Michigan and a lawyer from Baylor. And then after I got out of Texas Tech, I went to law school for a year. And just so you know, for anybody who's looking to go to law school, you have to study to become a lawyer. I said, you know what? After the first year, I was like, my grades were horrible. I said, you know what? I'm going to go be a pilot. They don't have to study. And then I went from basically waking up at like 9, 10 o'clock, going to class and doing the Socratic method where they'd be, hey, Mr. Jeffrey, please stand up, tell us the facts of this case, and then going through that, to waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning, getting in front of a Marine yelling at me because I was up at Enid, Oklahoma, and they had Marines as our flight commanders. And 5 o'clock in the morning, having a Marine yell at you, Lieutenant Jeffrey, stand up. I was like, oh my gosh, this is not going to go well. But I was married, and my wife helped me get through pilot training. And then when I saw one of the flight commanders was a C-5 pilot, and I was like, man, that guy's really big. I'm a taller guy. And so I was like, you know what? Let me talk, see what he does. He gets to fly the C-5. So I was like, okay, I want to go fly the C-5. C-5 looks awesome. And then I asked my wife, you want to go West Coast or East Coast? Because we're from Middle America, you know, Texas. And she said, let's go East Coast. And so we flew out to Dover, and it's really, we flew to DCA in Washington, got this, it was hilarious. They gave us this orange, bright orange Corvette, not Corvette. It was a Mustang, a top down. So we're driving through DC thinking we're just big stuff. You live in the big city lights. We go over the 4-lane, down to 3-lane, over the Bay Bridge, down to 2-lane. Down to 1-lane, and it's like this turn off to the right. It says Dover this way, and we're like, what in the world? And we get into Dover, Delaware, and it's center pivots, and it's buggies, and it's corn and wheat. And I mean, like, are we back home? And we drive in, and it's just a small little town. And from there, I got to fly the C-5 around the world, and it's awesome to be back.
And we're glad to have you back. Some of the highlights of your career, obviously, in your official bio, you talked about leading up to that first assignment in Dover. So I don't want to dive in too much about some of the other operational assignments since that's on the internet. What is something that's not in the bio that you want your airmen to know about you?
I've thought about that question a bunch because on one hand, I want people to know that they can always come and talk to me because I listen. And I've had multiple people in here already just laughing. I've had people in here crying and had people just telling stories that just need to talk. And so I want people to know that I will listen and I will help and I want to take care of airmen. Get our mission done first. It's mission first, but people always, because the people, if we don't have the right people, the right place at the right time, trained, ready to roll, why are we even here?
as a group commander, developing some of those leadership skills that are going to serve you here in the wing, of course, but it is a transition. How is that transition going so far, and how do you project it might go going forward?
Crazy, crazy. The transition has been crazy. And the reason I say crazy, I went from a group of about 130 plus individuals to this incredible, massive wing. And so fortunately, Colonel Gormley, the wing commander at Tinker, he allowed me to step into some of the roles sometimes and help lead the wing because he might be off and he'd be like, hey, Doug, you got the reins. And so that was a good thing because I got to see some of the inner workings and work with him to help lead the Okies. And then when I had the opportunity to come down here, even moving down here the first couple of days, when people started talking about the size and the scope, and it just kept on going and going, it's crazy. I mean, to think that all of these people are here to do the mission and to have one of the largest wings in Africa here, combine it with the 960th, we serve a massive amount of people. Airmen from all over the nation, they come here, they do the mission, and it's awesome. I've been extremely impressed with the people.
That scale of the wing, I think, is what makes one of your earliest moves, which was to put out your commander's intent so that all our airmen can understand where you're coming from, even if you haven't had a chance to interact with them personally. I want to key in on one of the terms that you mentioned, people always, right? One of the important cornerstones of your intent. That being said, if someone only takes away one or two things from that intent, what would you want it to be?
I tell people to start with the end in mind. One of the things I love to read, and one of the books I've been reading recently, is talking about how Amazon develops products. And one of the things that Jeff Bezos does is he will, before they even develop a product, he goes to the product teams. He says, I want you to write basically the press release and then develop the product that meets that press release. So when I look at the end state of what I want and what we need, what our nation needs, the 433rd, the Alamo Wing to be, is we have to be able to operate in a contested environment, in a joint environment with professional military organizations across the gambit with international partners in and out. And it's not just about flying, because we provide strategic outlet, strategic cargo, and the C5 is uniquely capable. We train the students to do that, but we also have the medical. We also have the FSS. We also have the cops. We also have the CR. I mean, like all of these things, it's a miniature, like a microcosm of the Air Force. And what I want us to think about is, what is the end state? And if we're able to do our mission, then that's success. That is taking away from my intent. I gave it because in the past, I didn't have that. And I wanted that because I needed the bumpers, the rails, the curbs, however you want to call it, so where I could know what are my left and right limits. And I need people to know that I trust them and I trust their commanders, I trust their SELs to keep them safe. Because those bounds, if they're operating and they don't have communication with their leadership, then okay, what's the commander overarching? What is our intent? If they can follow within those, I mean, there's goodness to that. And we know that they're accomplishing the mission.
You mentioned end state, which I think is a term that is more important than ever in military circles. I know when I was serving in the Army, that was one of the things they keyed in for us, where it was understand the end state and work to get there within the intent that's been laid out by the commander, right? And so that being said, what is the end state you want to see whenever the time? I know it's early, but when that time comes to pass the reins and move on to another assignment after the Alamo Wing, how will you judge if the time here for you as commander has been a success?
We live in a very interesting time. Currently, we don't have any named actions, battles, anything going on a major scale, not like in Iraq and Afghanistan, Enduring Freedom in Iraq. We don't have anything like that. Now, we do have troops in harm's way. We have been since the founding of our nation. But we are in a unique time where we have to be ready. And so when you talk about what I would see as a successful end state, let's say it's 2-3 years down the road, and I look back, is if the nation called, whether that be through some humanitarian, some active combat, whatever the nation calls, if in 2-3 years, I can look back and say, we were ready, we answered the call and we were ready for the next fight as we transformed for the future. It's very simple. I mean, that's what our boss's boss, the CAFR, has said. He wants us to be ready now and transform for the future. So if I can look back in 3 years and say, okay, did we answer the call? Yes. Okay. That's the end state. That's what I will say. We were successful. Now, along the way, did we take care of airmen? And did we make sure that we transitioned them from airmen coming out of basic? Maybe it's a captain. Did that captain promote? Did that lieutenant make it to captain? Did that tech sergeant make it to master? What are the things? There's different metrics that we can look at. But ultimately, the end state is, when the nation called, were we able to answer?
And of course, what you're mentioning there is the cornerstone of the new prevailing strategic mindset, not just at the Air Force level, but the DoD level, which is great power competition. One of the keys is optimizing for great power competition, right? As shared by General Alvin at the highest levels of the Air Force. How do you plan to optimize the Alamo Wing for great power competition?
The first question I would have to ask anyone, and I really, when I talk to people, the people I talk to most are the group commanders. I say, group commanders, I need you to be commanders. I need you to trust your squadron commanders to be squadron commanders, to trust your SELs to be the leaders of the organization to help make this thing work. So as we prepare for the great power competition, we have to make sure that we are ready now. So it goes back to the training. But also, we have to think differently. We have to be able to not micromanage. I mean, there's nothing worse than a micromanager. And so a lot of things that you'll be seeing from me, driving from my intent, is I'm going to let commanders be commanders. That I have to have them be commanders. Because in a great power competition, I hope and pray that we never have to go against China. I want to be ready to, just in case, and I want to deter them, just in case. But I hope that we don't have to. That being said, we're going to be ready. So I need my commanders to be able to delegate down to the lowest level. You'll see in the intent, hey, I want the right risk at the right level. So you may be out on an island, and I talked to the medical group this morning about it. You may have a filled hospital on some tiny island, and you don't have senior leadership, or senior leadership got hurt. Senior leadership is out of the picture. Comms are down. Okay. Tech sergeant, okay, second lieutenant, y'all are out there. What are you going to do? We have to improve our position. We have to take care of the mission. We have to keep the mission going. So from a med group standpoint, how are you taking care of the airmen that are within your care? Because if it comes down to a shooting war, there's going to be some death. There's going to be some destruction. And that's something that we have to mentally prepare ourselves for, because this generation that is coming into the Air Force is coming into an Air Force that hasn't had to deal with active combat. Like, think about that. As I'll just call myself seasoned, not old, but seasoned aviator, I've flown in to and been in and around places that we were shot at, that we had missiles launching in and around us. The new airmen coming in right out of basic, they don't have that. And so we have to leverage and we have to mentor, we have to teach, we have to prepare them. Again, we got to be ready for what's coming.
You mentioned the Pacific, China, one of the named adversaries, right? Though our goal is to deter and be prepared. I've heard in other venues, the tyranny of the Pacific is time and distance. I think that means the C-5's strategic airlift capabilities are a huge enabler in a theater like the Pacific. But I wanted your take on why you think the C-5's strategic capabilities are going to be vital to be prepared for anything.
Absolutely. I think I'm actually positive. My longest sortie, my longest flight was in the C-5, flying from Diego Garcia all the way up to Japan. It was a long flight, and that wouldn't be the longest one that we might have to do if we were to have to go to war in the Pacific. Man, and just saying that, the war in the Pacific. I listened to a book on tape. My wife laughs at me. It's not book on tape. It's Audible, so it's not. I apologize. I will always call them books on tape. But I was listening to a couple of them, and one of them was about World War II and just how the island hopping, and that really is what we might have to do. And how we do that, it will depend on logistics, because logistics wins wars. Now, if you want something, a large amount of something, at old General tell a story about there was, I think it was Guam, and they had a massive typhoon that came through, wiped down all the telephone poles. And so like, hey, send the C5, send the C17s. We're going to load them up with telephone poles. And it was going to take something like 300 or 400 C17, C5 equivalents to get all the poles there. And it was going to take our entire Air Force to do it. And by the time they all flew and the distance involved, it actually would have been better just to use a ship to load all those 300 equivalents up, take 2 weeks, get it there, and they would have it there, and then we could use air power to do other things. So when you talk about the tyranny of distance, the lengths that we have to go, it's a massive ocean with few and far between waypoints and way stations. There's some awesome locations. Pago Pago out in the middle of the ocean. I mean, like, it's some of my favorite trips have been out in the Pacific. Going into Australia, some partnerships. We have to make sure that we're taking care of the people out there, the partnerships, because the people who are, that's their own backyard. If we don't make sure that we ensure partnerships, we will fail. And I was over at the international partners schools that we have here at Lackland. And man, it's cool to see all of those partnerships. It's great that the C5 has legs and we can get up and we can go. I've taken an M1 battle tank from CONUS all the way over into Iraq and dropped it off. And you talk about projecting battle power. Let's go. Flown helicopters all the way from CONUS all the way in. I took an Apache simulator in a semi truck that had like 2 inches clearance, might have been 3 inches clearance, in a C5 with all the special shoring from the States all the way over. We have the ability to move mountains. And if you've ever seen a C5 taxiing, it looks like a building moving around. It's awesome. It has capability. We can use it and we will.
As a former Army guy, one of the favorite stories I've had a chance to cover here at the 433rd and the public affairs team is for the Great Texas Air Show, we brought an M1 down from Fort Cavazos to Randolph for the air show. And it put a smile on my face, I'll be honest.
Right, I get it, man. It going with the amount of Army material, I mean, it's incredible to see what the C5 can really hold. Whenever our enemies change tactics, you want the troops on the ground that we're protecting to have the ability to also be mobile and be able to transition. So one of the things that we got to carry was Buffaloes. Massive, because IEDs were being a deal and they were just like blowing up a bunch of our equipment. Well, the U.S. got these new Buffaloes, and the Buffalo had these V-shaped bottoms, taking those over, and that was a concerted effort. Hey, we need to get these over to the troops because these are going to help save lives. That is what we can bring, because again, with medical, they have these special kits that they can put aboard and be like basically a hospital. We can take one up and that's going to be needed. Again, with the tyranny of distance, talk about the golden hour. If someone gets hurt, you may not have a golden hour to get to a Landstuhl, one of those big facilities in Ramstein or something like that, because we won't have the hub and spoke. We'll have tiny little islands. So will that island be able to help airmen or help soldiers, help Marines, whoever it is? Will it be there at the time that they're needed?
Absolutely. And I love that you said logistics wins wars, because that's definitely a phrase that, as someone who's historically minded, it's always on my mind too, is logistics wins wars. Are we prepared to generate the logistics necessary to achieve victory, right? I think that's an awesome 30,000 foot view of the situation, but a lot of our airmen are operating more on the 10 foot level, maybe we'll call it. So I want to bring it back. The UEI was a close target that we just engaged. And now we're on the other side assessing. You took the stick right before the UEI. No pressure.
I laugh. It's yes, right before. Talk about coming into a just, again, a crazy whirlwind and all of the things. To me, the biggest takeaway from the UEI is we passed. Hey, great. Congratulations. We worked hard. We passed. With the airmen that I've met and that I've talked to, it's not necessarily the airmen that did that score, because if you look at the score, I mean, like, it, I tell people we got a 70. Hey, 70's passing. I will take it any day, every day. It means the schedule for the next one comes out like in 3 or 4 years. It's not a year, so we passed. But in talking with the airmen, they know that we can do better. And it's the systems that are in place that we as leadership have to go back and take a hard look at to make sure we're just getting the basics right. Because a lot of the things that the inspectors found, it's just kind of basic stuff. When you look at that, and when I have the lead inspector saying, hey, here's some things that we see, it's back to the basics. Are we taking care of airmen? At every staff meeting I start, are we paying our airmen on time? Do our airmen know what status they're in? I mean, I'm the world's worst reservist. I'll just tell you right now, I'm bad. I came in, and all those people who I've worked with, I try, because there's so many different systems and ways to be paid. So are we doing that? Are we taking care of airmen? Are we paying them? Do they know where they are? Do they know what status they're in? Are we making sure they're getting promoted? Are we making sure they're getting evaluated? Are we giving decorations? And oh, by the way, are we doing our mission? So there's things within the wing that had minors and significance. I won't get into all of those, but I know that on a fundamental level with the people that I met that we can do better, and we will.
Can I draw you out on maybe one or two things that you think are, I don't want to call it an easy kill, right? Nothing is easy, but one or two things that you're like, we can fix that right away. That's a 30 to 60 day correction.
I love 30 to 60 day problems. All right. So the one thing that I think would be an easy kill, but it's gonna require different mentality. Okay. I see how much we, and we've already started going down this path. This is a 30,000 foot view. From an obligation standpoint, we weren't doing as good as I would have thought at obligate air money. And we live in a budgetary environment where it's like feast or famine. Like we may budget for $38 million for the year. In the first quarter, we get $100. And then the second quarter, we get $10,000. And so then the last part of the year, we're like, oh gosh, we got to spend 34, 36, I don't even, bad math, multi-millions of dollars. So what I want us to do is, if we have money able to be spent on organizing, training, and equipping, I want us to make sure that we're obligated almost to 100%. Because when we do that, then I have the ability as the wing commander to go and advocate for more resources for our airmen, for that additional training. The things that, there's one thing to be current, and there's another thing to be proficient. Current will get us by, proficient will win wars. So, and there's somewhere in between that. So I want to make sure that we're obligating our money at an efficient pace to make sure that I have the ability to go advocate for more resources.
That makes a lot of sense. As you said, feast or famine. You couldn't have put it better for today's budgets, ups and downs.
And, right? And we have to be ready to execute. So I've tasked all the squadron and group commanders and SELs, hey, I need you to ensure that you have lists ready to go if we have a feast, like at a moment's notice. Because what happens is, big Air Force sends the numbered Air Force, well, the command and the numbered Air Force, this pot of money. It says, hey, we got a release of funds. Go, here you go. Well, if you're not ready for that, and if you're not, I mean, this goes back to be ready, right? If we're not ready to spend that in a smart way that's organized, training, and equipping, or with the equipment that will help us organize, train, and equip, and another wing is, well, the money comes in and it sits for a week, and if we don't spend it, and the other wing does, and they say, hey, well, we have some other things that we'd like to purchase. As the numbered Air Force commander, I'd be like, oh yeah, you're taking what I said. Okay, we're going to give you more money. And oh, by the way, we're going to take money from the wings that don't. So we have to be ready.
That being said, at a command as large as a wing, one of the issues, trying to put my airman hat on, right, is
sure.
Communication from the wing command level down to the airmen in the flights can be difficult. There's a lot of points along the chain that have to relay the message correctly along the way. How would you like to get after mitigating that problem or reducing it?
That's a good one. So I try to help people understand that an email sent is not an email received or understood. There's been multiple times in my life where I get emails from on high and I don't read them. I'm like, yeah, whatever. I'm not going to read it. And so I understand that we live in a different world and that some people are better face-to-face. Some people are better in writing. Some people are better electronically. I will try as best I can in multiple venues to get my message out. I won't do too many commander letters. One of them was, hey, we get family days back. Hope that's okay. That was my first official act as the wing commander. I was like, hey, we're gonna have family days.
Good first choice.
I'm trying. I mean, like that to me, easy kill. The second was the commander's intent. So you, as an airman at the lowest level, and I've tasked my group commanders and squadron commanders and SELs to make sure that this is up and that airmen know that I trust them and that this allows their commanders to trust them, to allow to push the things down to the lowest level and not be so top heavy. Because for me as a wing commander, having other people being able to do the mission and me being able to lead from the bottom, say, hey, this is where we're going to go. Now y'all execute it. I could go down to the lowest airman and be like, okay, here's where I want you to check the box. Oh, nope, check this box. Oh, nope, check this box. I could do that. But that's not going to help us in a great power competition. They need me to be fighting for more resources on a grand scope. And I need the mid-tier, the CGOs, the NCOs, because those are the core of how we win. Because all the other armies in the world, they don't have NCOs like we do. That middle core is why Russia is getting just decimated, because they don't have the ability to talk from the high echelons to the low echelons. And the low echelons know that they can't do what they want to do because it may not be within their commander's intent, because their commanders don't trust them. It's like, hey, you will do this. Okay, if I don't do that, what do I do? We want to empower our airmen to improve their position at all times. Improve it. Don't settle. If there's a problem, fix it. Those are simple things. Again, this is General Durham's. Back to basics. If you can do it, get it done. And if you can get it done in a better way, let us know. Let's benchmark it. Let other people know.
And I think that goes back to taking care of airmen. I wanted to get to the point of improving our airmen means making them better in every possible way. And to me, that requires mentoring. So what are your expectations for leaders like SELs or NCOs? What are your expectations for them as they're mentoring airmen?
Absolutely. At every location I've been at, I've told the people who are my peers and even the ones above me, we have to mentor. We have to train up our replacements. Because as we grow, and right now, I'm towards the end of my career. I mean, just sheer fact is that we got limits. I'm a colonel. There's not much above me. I have to make sure that I'm training my replacement. Go down the line. As an OG, I had to make sure that I was training my replacement. As a squadron commander, I had to make sure I was training my replacement. As a flight commander, I had to make sure I was. So it's this whole gambit that we as a reserve force have to do a better job. And that's across the, because we have multiple 06 vacancies across the board. And now we have active duty, and I love active duty. I was active duty for 14 years, loved it. But when they come across, they don't necessarily know the reserve way of life and how we do things. And there's some learning curves. There's some churn. Anytime you have churn in a system, airmen are not going to be working at peak performance. So we have to train up our replacements to be colonels, to be lieutenant colonels, to be majors, to be chiefs, to be seniors, to be masters, to be all the way. If you're not training up your replacement, if you're not showing them the path, they don't have to walk it. And that's one thing. I'm like, I've sat in many mentoring sessions and be like, hey, here's the path. It's up to you to walk it. If you do XYZ in the Air Force right now, you will make rank. If you do the right type of testing, if you do the right type of skill level, if you're doing those things, you'll promote. I mean, it's very simple. We have to show them the path because they don't know what they don't know.
Absolutely. I want to close with a question that I think is perfect for a seasoned aviator.
Mm.
Learning from mistakes as a cornerstone of life and leadership. What is the most memorable or some of the most memorable lessons you've learned along the way?
The best lesson, or one of the most memorable lessons I have, is having trust in the airmen around you and be willing to listen. I mean, like really listen. Not just, I think about something else. Really listen. Example. So I was at squadron officer school, and there was another, I think it was a captain. And this dude's like an ultra marathoner, like just phenomenal in shape, just doing like a million push-ups, a million sit-ups, doing all this stuff, just hammering it out. He was doing these sit-ups And I think it was a time deal. It might have been like you had to do like 40 sit-ups or something. And he was like at 70 or 80, just racking them out. And one of these just micromanagers rolls up, is like, none of those count. And this is like 10 seconds left. The guy still like rocks out like 20 or 30. I mean, it just, he was a machine. He goes, yeah, you failed. And I'm like, what? Literally, this guy is doing all these sit-ups and like you come in the last like 10 seconds, like, yeah, none of those count. And he still almost, he almost passes in 10 seconds what other people are like on the struggle bus to do. So I'm like, that's not right. And so I went to the flight commander and I was like, hey man, this is, I didn't say, hey man. I was like, hey sir, here's the thing. Explain the situation. He's like, no. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the group commander. Went to the group commander. He's like, nope, he failed. So I go to the wing commander. I'm like, wing commander, here's the situation. This is what happened. And the wing commander's like, that's dumb. Yeah, he passes. It enabled that guy to go from failing to graduating top third of the class. Having trust and fighting for people who are around you and with you, that's what makes the difference, is working through the micromanagement, working through the bureaucracy, because all of us have to do it. But fighting for our airmen, that's what it's about.
Couldn't think of a better point to close on, sir. I know you're a busy man, so let you get back to the business of running the wind, but I really appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation with me. I hope our airmen learn a little bit more about you and start building that trust that you were talking about that's key to everything that we do. Colonel Douglas Jeffrey, the new commander of the 433rd Airlift Wing.
Appreciate it.
Colonel Jeffrey's assumption of command is Sunday, August 4th at 1300. It's happening at the Fingston Reception Center on Joint Base San Antonio Lackland. All wing members receive the details of the event through their military emails. Before we go, we want to remind the Alamo Wing about the upcoming Family Day. It is Sunday of the September UTA, which is September 15th. Again, look to your military emails for further information. And the 433rd Public Affairs Office is still accepting nominations for the upcoming Boss Lift, happening Saturday, September 14th. The Boss Lift is an incentive flight for employers of Alamo Wing reservists. If you feel your boss has been particularly supportive of your duties as a reservist, go ahead and drop a nomination for them. The deadline for nominations is August 16th. Please submit your nominations using the form that was emailed out. You can return the completed forms to the PA Org Box, which is 433-AWPA@us.af.mil. On that note, that is going to be it for this edition of Ready, Set, Airlift. As always, we appreciate you spending some of your time with us. Remember to subscribe, follow, or give us a like if you are enjoying the show on whichever podcast platform you prefer. It really does help us know how we're doing. You can also leave us a review or send an email to airliftpodcast@gmail.com. That's airliftpodcast@gmail.com. On behalf of the public affairs team, we wish you a smooth and effective UTA. I've been your host, Julian Hernandez. Until next time, stay classy, Alamo Wing.